Chapter 10, The Seventh Principle, Compassion. Quote, true compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It understands that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. Unquote. That's Martin Luther King, Jr. There's a widely told story that speaks to the value of compassion. It seems that a woman who lived a Tao-centered life came upon a precious stone while sitting by the banks of a running stream in the mountains, and she placed this highly valued item in her bag. The next day, a hungry traveler approached the woman and asked for something to eat. As she reached into her bag for a crust of bread, the traveler saw the precious stone and imagined how it would provide him with financial security for the remainder of his life. He asked the woman to give the treasure to him, and she did, along with some food. He left ecstatic over his good fortune and the knowledge that he was now secure. A few days later, the traveler returned and handed back the stone to the wise woman. "I've been thinking," he told her. "Although I know how valuable this is, I'm returning it to you in the hopes that you could give me something even more precious." "What would that be?" the woman inquired. "Please give me what you have within yourself that enabled you to give me that stone," said the man. The woman in this story was living her life from a sacred place of compassion, which is the seventh and last principle for an excuses-begone life. Compassion and excuses. It's impossible to need excuses when the focus of life shifts to how may I serve. Thinking of others first, reaching out to them despite how it might inconvenience you, causes you to feel joy, which is what the hungry traveler was actually seeking. This gift of feeling good or feeling God within comes from serving and surrendering rather than asking and demanding. There's no room for blame in your life as long as you live with kindness. And excuses, regardless of their form, are all about blame. Blaming your past, blaming the economy, blaming your perceived personal flaws, blaming God, blaming your parents, blaming your children or your spouse, blaming your DNA. There's no shortage of circumstances, people, and events to blame, and there's no shortage of blame itself. When you shift to compassion, blame disappears. So no matter what you may want for yourself, discover how you can want it more for someone else and then make that shift. In that contemplative moment, compassion will eradicate finger-pointing and trump excuse-making. And you'll begin to think like God thinks, serving, offering, giving, and loving freely. The wise woman in the mountains who gave the precious stone to a stranger had no need to think about poverty or unhappiness, to hold a cynical view toward the greedy masses, or to explain the way she lived her life. Why? Because her ego was out of the picture, and love and service reigned supreme. I've certainly found that when I remember to nurture kindness and courtesy, everything in my life seems to move towards more harmony and peace, to say nothing of how much better I feel when I'm giving rather than wanting. I heard the Dalai Lama speak on compassion some years back, and the essence of his message contained these two points. One, that compassion is the single most important quality that humanity needs to learn. This is the way to find happiness and health and to feel successful. And two, that war and violence would become extinct in one generation if, beginning at the age of 5, children were taught to meditate on compassion for an hour a week for the rest of their lives. Such is the power of a compassionate approach to life, which is truly thinking of others and living by the ancient golden rule. The very second you feel yourself retreating to excuses, repeat the mantra, "How may I serve?" Then act upon the answers you receive. You'll become aligned with universal mind, which is always giving, and the bonus is that you'll notice the universe asking you back, "How may I serve you?" As your compassion for others flows back to you, remember the truth I've written about many times in this book. You do not attract what you want. You attract what you are. So make compassion be what you are. Three questions. For the past several years, I've celebrated Father's Day in a way that reflects what this chapter is about. I give special gifts to my 8 children rather than receiving presents from them. Being a father is one of the greatest privileges that I've enjoyed for more than 40 years. I consider it an incredible honor as well as a sacred undertaking to parent my 6 beautiful girls and my 2 handsome sons. So it's my wish to thank them for choosing me as their dad and for allowing me to play this glorious role in their lives. I think of the responsibility of raising and supporting a child as an amazing gift because to be able to fully support another human being is as close to being in a place of God realization as there is. After all, when God contemplates us into existence, doesn't he or she support us and allow the free will to choose a compassionate existence? This past Father's Day, my gift to my children was a copy of Leo Tolstoy's short story, Three Questions. Tolstoy tells of a king who was certain that if he just knew the best time to act, the right people to listen to, and above all, the most important thing to do at all times, he'd never fail in anything he might undertake. So he proclaimed that he would bountifully reward anyone in his kingdom who could teach him the answer to these three questions. Many learned men came to see the king, but since they all responded differently and he didn't agree with any of them, none of these men were rewarded. But the king still greatly desired to have his three questions answered, so he decided to consult a hermit who was widely known for his wisdom. The reclusive old man only received common folk, so the king put on simple clothes, left his bodyguards, and dismounted from his horse and went to see him by himself. When the disguised king reached the hermit, he asked him his three questions, but the elder fellow didn't answer. Noting that the hermit was very frail and attempting to dig some flower beds, the king took over, shoveling earth for hours. When he attempted his questions again, the hermit noticed a bearded man running out of the woods, holding his hands over a profusely bleeding wound in his abdomen. The hermit and the king took the bearded man inside and tended to him. The next morning, the man asked the king to forgive him, even though the ruler was certain he'd never even seen this man before. The injured man explained, "You do not know me, but I know you. I am that enemy of yours who swore to avenge himself on you because you executed his brother and seized his property. I knew you had gone alone to see the hermit, and I resolved to kill you on your way back. But the day passed, and you did not return. So I came out from my ambush to find you, and I came upon your bodyguards, and they recognized me and wounded me. I escaped from them, but should have bled to death had you not dressed my wound. I wished to kill you, and you have saved my life. Now, if I live, and if you wish it, I will serve you as your most faithful slave, and will bid my sons do the same. Forgive me." The king not only forgave him, but he also said that he'd send his servants and his own physician to attend to the man, and he promised to give him back the property that had been taken from him. At that point, the king went outside and saw the hermit placing seeds in the beds he'd dug the day before. He decided to ask the old sage his three questions one final time, and was surprised when the elderly fellow responded that his queries had already been answered. "How answered? What do you mean?" asked the king. "Do you not see?" replied the hermit. "If you had not pitied my weakness yesterday and had not dug those beds for me, but had gone your way, that man would have attacked you and you would have been repented of not having stayed with me. So the most important time was when you were digging the beds, and I was the most important man, and to do me good was your most important business. Afterwards, when that man ran to us, the most important time was when you were attending to him. For if you had not bound up his wounds, he would have died without having made peace with you. So he was the most important man, and what you did for him was your most important business. Remember, then, there is only one time that is important. Now, it is the most important time because it's the only time when we have any power. The most necessary man is he with whom you are, for no man knows whether he will ever have dealings with anyone else. And the most important affair is to do him good, because for that purpose alone was man sent into this life." Now let's go over the three questions as they pertain to your living from a place of compassion. As you listen to this section, think about the lessons that the king learned from his wise teacher, the hermit, as well as what can be taken from the example of the wise woman who gave away her precious stone to a traveler. 1. What is the best time to do each thing? Both the hermit and the wise woman understood what Tolstoy meant when he wrote, quote, "Remember, then, there is only one time that is important. Now, it is the most important time because it is the only time when we have any power," unquote. You may recall that the third excuses be gone principle explained that compassion can only be experienced in this current moment. Now is where everything takes place. So your relationship to life is truly your relationship to the present moment. I love the definition of compassion offered by historian Arnold Toynbee, quote, "Compassion is the desire that moves the individual self to widen the scope of its self-concern to embrace the whole of the universal self," unquote. In any given moment of your life, when you embrace another beyond any concern for yourself, you are living compassion. You're also making it impossible to employ excuses. Thus, you now know the secret that Tolstoy's king sought and the wise woman knew instinctively. This is the time to widen your scope beyond self-concern and embrace a universal self that includes everyone, especially the person who is before you. Can you imagine that compassionate woman or wise hermit coming up with an excuse for life not working at the level they liked? Be like them and recognize that this moment is your power. Seize it and extend compassion without regard for yourself. And remember that your appointment with life is always in the present. 2. Who are the most important people to work with? We often hear about and respond to the importance of offering assistance to others in drastic need in faraway places. As we try to work towards bringing about world peace, we join organizations dedicated to improving the lives of those who are most needy. Yet this doesn't answer this second question adequately. Whoever is in your immediate space is the most important person for you to work with, be it friend, family member, co-worker, or total stranger. Therefore, extend kindness to whomever you see before you. As Tolstoy reminds you, you can't know that you'll ever have dealings with anyone else. This is your moment, and the person to work with is right here. The wise woman understood this well. She wasn't saving the precious stone for herself, for someone more deserving, or for a relative. She gave her gift, which came from her compassionate heart, to a person she'd never met before. So the lesson is, don't look beyond the moment. Now is a perfect opportunity. Whoever is in your presence is the one who is available for your compassion. As the Vietnamese master Thich Nhat Hanh once observed, if you cannot make your own child happy, how do you expect to be able to make anyone else happy? If all our friends in the peace movement or of service communities of any kind do not love and help one another, whom can we love and help? Are we working for other humans, or are we just working for the name of an organization? And 3, what is the most important thing to do at all times? The compassionate actions of the hermit and the wise woman show that they both knew the answer to this question very well. Tolstoy concludes 3 questions by explaining why compassionate action toward the person in the moment is so highly esteemed. Because for that purpose alone was man sent into this life, he said. As we learned in the last chapter, doing good is the equivalent of doing God. We're not here to conquer others, to wage war, to build towering temples to our deities, to become number one, to win anything or defeat anyone. No, we are here to be like God, or to be good, to serve, to reach out, to allow, not interfere, and be humble wherever we go. Give your ego a rest and live compassionately by being a decent human being. The king learned this when he let go of his importance. By simply doing good, he saved his own life. And the woman in the mountains was able to teach an ego-driven man how to be happy by a simple demonstration of goodness. Allow me to conclude this chapter by telling you another story, this one concerning myself and my daughter Summer. As I was driving her to the airport for her return to college after a long weekend home, she was admiring my new watch. Now, this was the first new timepiece I'd had in at least a decade. I really enjoyed looking at its shiny steel and black face as I did. I'd think about how this was my favorite watch of all time. Yet I knew in my heart that Summer would love to wear it, since men's watches seemed to be the current craze for young women. As I dropped my daughter off at the curb and assisted her with her luggage, I was prompted to remove the watch and give it to her, even though it was my most prized possession, particularly since I had almost no possessions any longer that I even care about, let alone prize. Summer's response was, "No, Dad, no, Dad," she said, "you love this watch." I insisted, telling her that I'd feel greater joy by giving it to her and knowing she'd treasure it. I also said that I felt it would symbolize our staying together in time, even though we'd be thousands of miles apart. She boarded her plane glowing, and I left feeling that I had grown immeasurably as a person, since such a compassionate act would have been very difficult, if not impossible, for me several years ago. Summer called me in Maui a few months later to tell me that she was sending me a present for Father's Day, stressing that it was a very, very special gift. It turned out to be her all-time favorite painting that she'd created and had hung in her apartment for a long time. As she told me later, "I really learned something the day you gave me your beloved watch, and I want to give you something that's my single most precious item. I'm giving it to you, Dad, even though it's difficult to part with, because I want you to have a piece of me that I love with you." The painting hangs proudly on my wall as a symbol of the beauty and perfection of reaching out compassionately in response to a felt moment. This personal story epitomizes and personalizes the response to Tolstoy's 3 questions. Number 1, do it now, the only moment available. 2, do it with the person you're with in the moment. And 3, do good, because that's why you're here. By being and living compassion, you invite and encourage others, just by your example, to choose to do the same. Suggestions for living from compassion. First, upon awakening, let the words thank you flow from your lips, for this will remind you to begin your day with gratitude and compassion. Make it a practice to begin each day by thinking first of someone else and then making a decision to actively do something, anything, that will bring a smile to his or her face. When you become conscious of wanting to do something kind for another human being, you move into a higher place, correction, you move into a higher way of being. It takes your thoughts off of yourself and what's in it for me and puts them on, how may I serve, which is precisely how the universal mind we call the Tao or God is always operating. When you're aligned with a compassionate outlook, your entire day will reflect this kind of awareness. Here are some suggestions to get you started. Email a note of appreciation. Say a kind word to one of your children with whom you've been having harsh words. Apologize to an individual you've needed to make amends with. Pick a few wildflowers and hand them to someone. Give away some personal items such as books or jewelry. Or send a smile toward someone that might brighten his or her moment. The point is that it doesn't have to cost money. What you're doing is aligning with compassion and thereby setting up your day to work in this way. Whenever you find yourself employing one of your personally familiar excuses, you can stop yourself in mid-thought and immediately shift to the person you showed such humanity toward. Note how excuses disintegrate when your thoughts are on being kind toward others. You needn't restrict your opening act of compassion to a person. All acts of kindness toward any of God's creatures, even if it's just picking up some trash that was carelessly discarded, impacts our planet. The point is to set your mind on serving and off of your ego's demands. And secondly, in the quote that opens this chapter, Martin Luther King Jr. suggests that our culture needs restructuring and that compassion is the way. I urge you to work towards electing people to public office at all levels who relate sensitivity and kindness in their messages to the public. Attitudes of compassion take into consideration men and women who are involved in concerns of immigration, torture, sexual orientation, religious persuasion, and socioeconomic status. There can be no exceptions here. Look for the compassionate heart, rather than the one that excludes, punishes, seeks revenge, or manipulates with government power. The more our institutions reflect this humane attitude, the fewer collective excuses we will call upon to explain why we haven't been able to create the heaven on earth that is our true calling. And third, as I've stated in each of the seven principles in this program, the active repetition of an inner mantra reinforces and creates exactly what you're saying to yourself. Thus, repeat the following to yourself for at least 5 minutes. Quote, I am a being of compassion. I extend love outward everywhere because this is my nature. Unquote. Affirm this to yourself continually and post it in a prominent place in your home, your office, or even your car. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus gives us the ultimate words of compassion. If our world today would put them into practice, we'd all be living in peace. But even if the rest of the world hasn't yet caught on, you can. I urge you to put these words of Jesus to work in your daily life. If you do, all excuses will most certainly vanish. Quote, ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Matthew 5:43-44. This is compassion in action. Part 3, The Excuses Be Gone, Paradigm Shift. Quote, if you correct your mind, the rest of your life will fall into place. Unquote. That's from Lao Tzu. And here's Chapter 11, A New Way of Looking at Changing Old Thinking Habits. Quote, never underestimate your power to change yourself. Never overestimate your power to change others. That's by H. Jackson Brown, Jr. By now, you surely understand that you have the power to fundamentally change how your brain works, altering its basic chemistry to eradicate old mind viruses. You know that you can become a person who no longer relies upon excuses. I've learned that what's true in nature is true for all humans in understanding ourselves. Just as the blossoms on a fruit tree fall away as the fruit grows, so does our need for a bouquet of rationalizations vanish as the divine produces the authentic self. The more we allow ourselves to be guided by the principles that identify us as spiritual, the less we have any desire or inclination to use excuses. As Carl Jung put it, our most important problems cannot be solved they must be outgrown. Outgrow your need to ever use an excuse again. Even before you start putting the paradigm in this part of the program to work, do what you can to move beyond problems that are related to your old thinking habits. The principles I talked about in part two are designed to help you grow from a human being having a spiritual experience to the reverse, a spiritual being having a temporary human experience. This is what Jung meant by outgrow, something nature always does with its problems. An acorn is just a tiny seed, a little nut that can't produce anything, yet, as I'm fond of saying, an infinity of force lies dormant within the dreams of one acorn. An infinity of manifestations lies dormant within you, but you must get past the dormancy of your old thinking. So to aid you in doing this, here's a brief review of the seven excuses begone principles I went through in part two. Become aware of your potential for greatness and the power of your mind. Align yourself by thinking like God thinks. Live here and now in your mind as well as in your body. Contemplate what you are rather than what you want to become. Be willing to allow health, happiness, and success to flow into your life. Be passionate about everyone and everything that enters your life. And want more for others than you do for yourself. That is, be compassionate. These seven tools will help you to outgrow your reliance on excuses and help you to correct your mind. When you're able to do this, as Lao Tzu reminded you earlier, the rest of your life will fall into place. Yes, you can correct your mind. In the first two chapters of this program, I described how a lot of time and effort has gone into convincing you to fit in and be like everybody else. That programming requires some effort on your part to overcome. As the poet E.E. Cummings explains, to be nobody but myself, in a world which is doing its best, night and day, to make you like everybody else, means to fight the hardest battle which any human being can fight, and never stop fighting. You can accomplish being nobody but yourself without the actual fighting, although you may feel that you're battling something within yourself. As you let the divine grow within you, however, you'll shift to a feeling of joy as the old discomfort retreats. As a young person, you are inundated by a whole slew of no-you-can't messages. These were subsequently internalized to you as I-can't thoughts, which were buttressed by well-intentioned excuses. You internalize the notion that I can't because you were repeatedly told the following: you'll never amount to anything, you're worthless, you're not smart enough, you were never good enough, money is hard to come by, you don't deserve to succeed, you'll never find someone to love you, you'll probably get sick like your mother did, it's in your genes, you'll never get ahead if you don't follow the rules, and you're just like your father and he never amounted to anything. These and thousands of variations on the same themes seem to have erected permanent barriers within you. Excuses feel like they protect you from such awful sentiments, as well as the present disappointments with your life. Even though you've become an adult with no rational reason to hang on to such memes, they still produce a familiar reaction when it seems necessary to defend why your life isn't at the optimal level you'd prefer. And while you probably had no idea that these messages had infiltrated your brain, they nevertheless have a very strong pull on you. Don't underestimate your power to change yourself, as the display quote that I read at the beginning of this chapter advises. You can absolutely overcome the internalized conviction of I can't, so that it quickly becomes I can by affirming the following. I can accomplish anything I choose. I am a worthy and valuable person. I am intellectually capable. I deserve the best because I am good. I attract abundance in all areas of my life. I deserve health, happiness, and success. I am loved by others, and I love myself. I am guided by my desire to serve others rather than following the rules. I am unique and independent of the good opinions of others. If you look closely at the preceding affirmations, you may note that they all represent a movement away from your old excuse-making mentality and toward thinking like God must think. Seven core ideas for eliminating excuses. Before I explain the excuses begone paradigm, I'd like to share with you a set of beliefs that I've adopted for myself. I encourage you to be receptive to these ideas, even if they initially seem inapplicable to your life at this time, because I feel strongly that they'll assist you in beginning the process of moving away from justification and defensiveness. Here are the 7 tips I've personally found to be very helpful in eradicating excuses from my own life. 1. Remove any and all labels. Old habits of thinking stick around often for an entire lifetime, largely because you create internal reasons to reinforce and maintain them. These reasons, which I'm calling excuses, can become permanently lodged in your subconscious. They're labels you place on yourself that ultimately become your self-definition. In the words of Soren Kierkegaard, the famed Danish theologian, "Once you label me, you negate me." As you enter the excuses be gone paradigm, make a promise to yourself that you won't be labeling or negating yourself anymore. My daughter Serena grew up labeling herself as not athletic or even frail, a self-definition that morphed into a comfortable excuse whenever physical activity came up. My daughter's labels negated the real Serena, who could become anything or anyone she chose. By consciously making a decision to remove those labels and nothing more, Serena has gradually become a young woman who enjoys participating in athletic events and who loves the positive changes in her body as a result of daily exercise. Rather than saddling yourself with self-limiting labels, affirm, "I am capable of accomplishing anything I place my attention upon." Make it clear to yourself that you can never negate the real you. You're an infinite being, and with God, all things are possible. The corollary of this would be, with labels, most things are negated. 2. Converse with your subconscious mind. I refuse to accept the idea that we have an unconscious mind that defies us by being completely inaccessible. To me, this is a prescription for believing that for the major portion of our lives, we're controlled by unseen and unavoidable forces residing within us. I recognize that we're often totally unaware of why we're behaving in certain ways, but this implies that we have no choice in the matter. Awareness is the simple key for alleviating this condition. Have regular conversations with your subconscious. Remind it that you don't want to go through life on automatic pilot. Discuss your unwillingness to be a victim of the whims of that ghost in the machine of your body, whose orders originated in the mind viruses and thinking habits that were programmed into it by people who are either long dead or no longer play a role in your adult life. I usually tell my own habitual mind things like this: "I know that I have some really silly leftover habits that were instilled in me a long time ago, and I want you to know that I'm no longer interested in being dictated to by you. I'm bringing all of those old habits of thought to the surface, and I'm going to make a conscious effort to be more aware of all aspects of my life." I had a conversation like this recently regarding my inclination to misplace my keys. I treated the ghost inside of me that always seemed to place my car keys in difficult-to-find locations as if it were a real person. While this may seem like an insignificant little habit, for me, changing it was huge. To this day, I rarely misplace my keys. Initiate a conversation with your subconscious mind in which you make it clear that you're not going to let a part of your life be run by an invisible stranger who acts and reacts on the basis of mimetic or genetic programming. Instead, decide that you're no longer going to allow or excuse behavior from an unconscious part of yourself. 3. Begin the practice of mindfulness. As you head into the 7 chapters that identify a new paradigm for ridding yourself of excuses permanently, I encourage you to begin a practice of being more mindful. This is, in fact, what I did to end my lifetime habit of being forgetful, particularly when it came to where I placed my keys. At one time, I simply excused my can't-find-my-keys behavior with this label: "I'm just forgetful." I can recall both my mother and my wife exclaiming, "Oh, that's Wayne, our absent-minded professor." Memes buried within my subconscious became useful excuses for explaining my habit of being forgetful. But then I discovered how to be mindful. I began to practice being conscious of what I used to do unconsciously, and it worked. Each time I came into the house, I made a decision to be aware of my keys in my hand, to feel the texture and shape of each one of them, to hold them with awareness, to listen to the jingle-jangle sound, and then place them in a special spot reserved just for them. And lo and behold, an old unconscious habit had been brought to the surface and into my conscious mind, causing that old excuse of being forgetful to be eradicated. On the rare day when I can't find my keys now, it only serves to reinforce my commitment to stay mindful. By the same token, there was a time when my yoga practice could deteriorate into a boring routine and I'd become frustrated with myself, or while swimming in the ocean or running along the beach or even sitting and writing, I could get lost in my old forgetfulness and lose sight of the glorious feeling that's available in all human activity. I found that practicing mindfulness in many ways throughout my day helped immensely. In his book, The Miracle of Mindfulness, Thich Nhat Hanh advises us on this practice. Quote, "The Sutra of Mindfulness says, when walking, the practitioner must be conscious that he is walking. When sitting, the practitioner must be conscious that he is sitting. When lying down, the practitioner must be conscious that he is lying down. The mindfulness of the positions of one body is not enough, however. We must be conscious of each breath, each movement, each and every thought and feeling, everything which has any relation to ourselves." Unquote. These days, when I swim, I experience my arms moving, my legs kicking, my shoulders stretching, the feel and taste of the salt water, my fingers cupped and moving through the water, my breathing, my heart rate, all of it. Practicing mindfulness has taught me how to be in the moment and to find myself as well as my keys. That makes me think of a story Mo Bi Ho, a Vietnamese scholar who translated Han's book, tells. Quote, "As I sat down to translate The Miracle of Mindfulness, I remembered the episodes during the past years that had nurtured my own practice of mindfulness. There was the time I was cooking furiously and could not find a spoon I'd set down amid a scattered pile of pans and ingredients. As I searched here and there, Han entered the kitchen and smiled. He asked, 'What is Mo Bi looking for?' 'Of course,' I answered, 'the spoon. I'm looking for a spoon.' Han answered again with a smile, 'No, Mo Bi is looking for Mo Bi.'" Unquote. Number 4. Commit to overcoming your inertia. The excuses you frequently employ have taken up residence in your mind, which is dominated by your ego or false self. Consequently, they won't simply pack up and leave without putting up a fight. Those excuses have become familiar companions with your ego, and they're always ready and willing to leap to your defense. What I've found very useful in overcoming these ego-enriched justifications is to have a conversation with myself about who I intend to be and what I'm willing to do in order to bring this about. I call this my commitment to overcoming inertia conversation. I'm aware of my instinctive impulse to stay with the familiar, to be inactive, and use the convenient excuses I delineated in Chapter 3. When it comes to fulfilling my commitment to complete a book at a certain time, for instance, I can always haul out, "I'm too busy. It's just too big. Oh, it's going to take a long time, and I really don't have the energy," and on they go. Yet my inertia conversation helps me to organize a few techniques to eliminate this excuse. The first thing I do is I draw up a contractual agreement with myself that I look at each day. After conversing with myself about overcoming inertia, I put a hand-drawn model of the book's jacket on my desk, so I'm writing from the perspective of acting as if what I want to complete is already here. I then continually remind myself that my word to my highest self, to God, is sacred, and this alone can push me in the direction of my writing space. Once I'm seated, all that procrastination, supported by excuses, disappears. Before beginning the paradigm I explain in the next chapters, I encourage you to make a commitment to give up inertia. Have a private conversation with your highest self, and be willing to hold on to its vision for you, even if your old excuses come trotting back hoping for a sign of weakness on your part. The written agreement helps you to recollect that you're in the process of redefining yourself. You are now practicing an excuses-begone philosophy for organizing and running your life. Number 5. Use the power of affirmations. You can make your entire living space an affirmation by having it reflect the energy you wish to utilize in fulfilling your personal destiny. My own living space reflects what I wish to have in my life, and I found this extraordinarily beneficial in underscoring my desire to cease using excuses of any kind. I affirm everything I am, all that I wish to become, and all that I treasure with written, photographic, artistic, and natural symbols of what I believe to be high energy sources. I stay in alignment with this kind of energy by surrounding myself with what I wish to attract. For example, I want love in my life, so I place symbols of it around as affirmations that I'm aligned with what I want to receive. These include photographs that inspire thoughts of love, fresh flowers that are God's gifts of love in the form of natural beauty, books about love, and written statements such as these that I'm looking at as I talk to you. Quote, love binds everything together in perfect harmony, said St. Paul. Or, quote, he whom love touches not walks in darkness. That's from Plato. And, quote, he who does not love does not know God, for God is love, unquote. And that's from John 4:8. Not only do you become what you think about all day long, you become what you avow to the universe as well. So before you start the excuses be gone paradigm in the following chapters, I urge you to make your home and your working space living testimonials to your highest desires. Affirm that you're deserving of all the abundance that the universe has to offer. Affirm your love for yourself. Affirm that you're a divine creation and thus willing and open to that divine source working on your behalf. Never underestimate the power of affirmations to help you eradicate the excuses you use to defend the shortcomings of your life. Number 6. Live in a helpful, supportive universe. One of the most important decisions you'll ever make is choosing the kind of universe you exist in. Is it helpful and supportive, or hostile and unsupportive? Your answer to this question will make all the difference in terms of how you live your life and what kind of divine assistance you attract. Remember that you get what you think about, whether you want it or not. So if you believe that this is an unfriendly universe, you'll look for examples to support this point of view. You'll anticipate people attempting to cheat, judge, and take advantage of and otherwise harm you. You'll blame the antagonistic, inhospitable cosmos for not cooperating with you in the fulfillment of your desires. You'll point the finger at belligerent people and bad luck for the kind of world we all live in. Since this worldview trickles down into every thought you have, you become a person persistently looking for occasions to be offended, and therefore in possession of a whole slew of excuses. I implore you to see the universe as a warm and supportive one before you begin to apply the excuses be gone paradigm. Because you'll look for evidence to support this view, when you anticipate that the universe is friendly, you see friendly people. You look for circumstances to work in your favor. You anticipate good fortune flowing into your life. In other words, you aren't looking for excuses. My favorite affirmation when I feel stuck or out of sorts is, whatever I need is already here, and it is all for my highest good. Jot this down and post it conspicuously throughout your home, on the dashboard of your car, at your office, on your microwave oven, or even in the front of your toilet. Remind yourself, I live in a friendly universe that will support anything or any desire that is aligned with the universal source of all. Such a stance will be a giant step toward living an excuses-begone life. Affirming that what you want is already here, and all you have to do is connect to it, causes you to remember that what you attract is for your highest good, so you can then let go of the timing issue altogether. Just know that it's all here and will arrive on God's schedule, as does everything that makes the journey from non-being to being. I found that by shifting my belief about the nature of the universe, I attract whatever I desire into my life. I desire love. I desire peace. I desire health. I desire happiness. I desire prosperity. Why would I want to hold the view that our universe is unsupportive, evil, and unfriendly? How could I expect the divine realm to hear me if I'm asking it to be something other than what it is? Thus I see my desires in perfect rapport with how the universe works. When I pray, I do so in the spirit of St. Francis. Rather than ask God to grant him peace, this inspiring man beseeched God to, quote, make me an instrument of thy peace, unquote. In other words, let me be like the source from which I originated, and then I will rest in the knowing that it must be here, on its way, and for my highest good. As you can see, there's no room for excuses when you apply this model to your everyday life. As I've written and said many times, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And this applies to the entire universe as well. Number 7. Don't complain, don't explain. Complaining and explaining are the two huge allies of excuse making. Generally speaking, when you resort to complaining, you employ an excuse of one kind or another, placing the responsibility for what's upsetting you on something or someone external to yourself. Complaining about the way somebody has performed or failed to perform is another way of making an excuse for why you're dissatisfied or unhappy. It's their fault that my blood pressure is up. Look at how miserably they've performed. Or, how can I enjoy myself at dinner when everyone here at this restaurant is behaving so incompetently? Are prime examples. Finding fault with circumstances, the weather, the economy, other people, or anything else outside yourself is a way to hang on to excuses. In addition to putting an end to complaints, I recommend that you never attempt to explain. As I've pursued a no-excuses mentality, I've made it my policy to keep the things that I wish to accomplish a private matter. By doing so, I'm never forced into a stance of having to explain myself. I'm well aware that many of my personal life missions sound strange and outrageous to others. Consequently, I've learned to avoid sharing my intentions with anyone outside of a select few whom I know and trust at a spiritual level. Anything I might say to these individuals wouldn't require me to explain myself in any way. The problem with having to explain yourself is that in doing so, you inevitably invoke the ego to do your bidding. You have a tendency to make yourself right, sensible, and understood, while at the same time dealing with the doubts and antagonisms of those who don't share your views or your optimism. When you keep things to yourself, you stay connected to your spiritual side, or the place within you that has no need to be right, or to make anyone else wrong. Since all of creation comes from the world of non-being, if you want to give life to your dreams and desires, if you wish to manifest your own destiny, then you must rely on the great source of all creation, Spirit. The moment you inject ego into the picture, you invite excuses. And the moment you invoke those familiar excuses, you stop the creative and the creation process from manifesting. As Lao Tzu put it, quote, "The Tao gives rise to all forms, yet it has no form of its own. Stop striving after admiration. Place your esteem on the Tao. Live in accord with it. Share with others the teachings that lead to it, and you will be immersed in the blessings that flow from it." Unquote. In more modern language, stop complaining and stop explaining. Your excuses will soon cease. These, then, are my 7 favorite ideas for you to contemplate as you prepare to study the Excuses Begone paradigm. How to use this paradigm. I created the Excuses Begone paradigm because of my strong belief in the spirit of the quote at the beginning of this chapter. Quote, "Never underestimate your power to change yourself. Never overestimate your power to change others." The key word in this quotation is power. I know there's a power within you that's capable of making dramatic changes in a relatively short period of time. The problem I've discovered is that most people feel disempowered when it comes to overcoming a lifetime of self-defeating thinking. It's actually quite easy to change the way we think and act, regardless of how long we've done it or how much reinforcement we've received that solidified a way of being. I put myself to this test on many occasions, and I've always found that making these changes is much simpler than others would have me think. I believe that in the same way our body knows how to maintain an optimal state of health without any outside interference, so too is our mind programmed by source energy to know how and what to think in order to optimize our emotional and spiritual development. I've stopped underestimating the power we contain within ourselves to make apparently radical shifts and have applied the Excuses Begone paradigm to overcome addictions of all stripes in my own life. I've also used it to help me attract the right people, the right circumstances, the right jobs, the funding I needed, the healing I desired, and so on. I've seen many individuals leave old thinking and behavior behind with very little time or hard effort devoted to the outcome. The impact of early imprinting and conditioning is felt throughout life until a change is initiated, but I've never bought into the idea that our early childhood programming is insurmountable. Nor do I accept that we have an unconscious mind that cannot be accessed. And you know that I even reject the idea that our genes and DNA are excuses for all manner of thinking and behavior. Rather, I've chosen to believe in the innate power within each of us to change. Each chapter that follows in this last part of this program is presented as a question to ask yourself. Take some time before you answer and listen through each of the chapters with a mind that's open to everything and attached to nothing. Consider the examples I present, examine both sides, and stay neutral in your assessment of how they apply to you today. In other words, just let it all in, particularly the parts that you immediately think don't apply to you. There are no exercises to do, no lists to make, no rules to follow, or complicated instructions to memorize. All you need do as you listen to the following chapters is to keep in mind the words of Lao Tzu, quote, "If you correct your mind, the rest of your life will fall into place." Unquote. This paradigm for changing habituated thinking is all about helping you to correct your mind. Enjoy, as everything else just falls into place.